This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits. Enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform, Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Media Explode, Episode 7.
Take 2.
My head is spinning. It's the beginning of the end. The people freak out when I walk out.
Welcome to iFanboy Media Explode, Episode 7. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. This is Josh Lanigan.
Hey.
And Ron Richards.
Oh, hey. I didn't see you come in there.
We're doing it again. This is the iFanboy Media Explode show, unlocked by the patrons over at patreon.com/iFanboy. And if you just happen to stumble into this show randomly, we normally do a show called The Pick of the Week, which is about...
No, don't tell them. I want them to be confused when they get the next episode.
Okay, well, we're over here now talking about the stuff we watched or listened to or whatever we did in between the last episode and this one, not related to comics.
I do love the idea of a new listener getting this, like, wow, they talk about movies and TV. This is awesome. And then the next episode come out and they're like, Bat what?
They'd have to really stumble around to get to this without knowing that.
Yeah, it's true. It's a good point. But you never know. Every episode is someone's first podcast.
That's right.
Yep.
So there'll be spoilers as we discuss the media we watched. This is the little show, very much like the end of the year show we do, in which we talk about the media we enjoyed throughout the year. This year's show for that one will be different because...
What are we going to do for that show, by the way? Because not only do we talk about everything monthly here, right, but we consumed a lot less. I mean, did either of you go see Tenet?
No.
Could you?
No.
I could.
No, they're closed here. Yeah. And also, no live shows. And anyway, we'll figure that out in December. It may be a half hour.
I mean, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll vamp.
It may be we just cut together these shows into one long show.
That's a good idea.
So, a lot less work.
Get on that, Kilpatrick.
All right, so we're going to talk about what we watched or listened to or whatever we did in the last few weeks since the last time we did this show, and Ron is going to kick it off.
Yes, I am, because I got so much crap for not wanting to go first previously, so I'm happy to go first. Since we last convened, I actually took up Josh on two of his recommendations. We watched all of Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus and really enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
How about that final episode, huh?
Episode 5 and the last episode were some of the best TV of the year. I think up there with that Maisel, the quarantine episode was up there with the Maisel Miami episode.
Yeah.
Connor, right?
Yeah.
Like possibly the best COVID-related media, like COVID-themed media I've seen in all the past 6 months. So great job.
That episode 5 was just...
5 was amazing.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we're like, I want to watch this show. But
I was halfway in and I went, wait, what is this? But I was so into it that I didn't even realize it.
Oh,
anyway,
so
we're not
good. So good job, Josh. And then me and my wife started watching Trust, and we're 6 episodes in and we're completely enthralled. So Josh, I love it when you suggest media to me. Thank you for the suggestions. I appreciate it.
Molto bene.
But in terms of the suggestions I bring to you, my dear friends and our listeners, kind of delved into documentary, docuseries stuff this past month. First up on HBO Max, thoroughly enjoyed the documentary Class Action Park, which is all about an amusement park called Action Park located in Vernon, New Jersey, that was open from the late 70s until the mid 90s. And if you grew up in the New York metro area, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really good. I saw this trailer, I want to say more than a year ago, and it looks like HBO Max snatched it up, and then they put a little more post-production. John Hodgman narrated it. Chris Gethard was one of the talking heads in it, so it got a little, you know, notable folks in it. You know, nostalgia plays, and if you grew up in the New York metro area in the 80s and 90s, there's no way you didn't know about Action Park. I do love amusement park. I never went to Action Park. The closest I ever came was when I was like 8 or 9. My dad took me to a car show in a field next to Action Park. And I'm there walking up and down rows of Mustangs and Shelbys and Cobras. And I could hear people screaming and laughing and having a great time. And I go, hey, Dad, let's go over there. And he's like, no, look at this engine over here. It's great. It's original. So that's the closest I came.
That's cruelty.
It made me a better man. Well, actually, it did, because honestly, what I didn't know, what I unwittingly, by my father not letting me go to Action Park, he unwittingly saved my life.
Clearly, that's true.
Because Action Park was a death trap that should never have been open for as long as it was, because the people designing the water slides and the rides were insane. And the fact that it was something that not only stayed open for as long, but thrived for years. And actually, the whole tone of the documentary, like, it starts off very, very funny about just how wild this place was. And then it gets a little down when they talk about, like, the people who died at it.
I swear this documentary came out 5 years ago. I don't understand. Maybe it was an article?
It might have been.
I swear I went through this whole, like, story before.
You're a reader, so...
You know. Maybe the people out there can tell me what I'm thinking of, because I swear this came up before.
Well, according to Wikipedia and IMDb, it's really a 2020 documentary. It premiered virtually at the 2020 Florida Film Festival.
Am I a time traveler?
You might be. Unless there was something similar about it, or who knows.
I don't know.
The kind of the underpinning tone of the documentary really zeroed in on the fact that, like, the 80s were this time of innocence and freedom for teenagers and kids growing up. And, you know, and Connor, you know, and Josh, we all grew up during the 80s, and it definitely, you know, the parenting now is different than it was back then. And the idea that you could, you know, hop in your friend's parent station wagon and go to this Action Park for a day and, like, literally come very close to dying and no one bat an eye at it, because it was just kind of like everyone assumed it was fine or was safe, or there wasn't as much kind of parental oversight going on because everyone was doing cocaine. You know, just really, really interesting about that idea of just like how kids had a lot more freedom and lived a little more of a dangerous lifestyle, because the innocence coming off of the 50s and the suburban, you know, kind of thing, hadn't, the fear of the 90s hadn't set in yet. You know that, like, yeah. Now, you know, like, now we live in a fear-based society that wasn't there in the '80s, and it comes out in the context of this insane waterslide park. So definitely recommend it. It was really, really interesting and a good entertainment for 90 minutes. Strongly recommend. And then my second thing I just want to recommend is on Netflix, also a docuseries, a 6-episode docuseries, 45 minutes or so per episode, called High Score, which is all about video games. And in fact, one of my friends, Jay, told me he watched it and said, "Ron, you need to watch this. You're going to hate it. But trust me, just watch it." And I was about halfway through the first episode, and I completely understood what he was talking about, because it was one of those slightly watered down for average audiences documentaries about the history of video games. And being as someone who loved video games, played computer games and all that sort of stuff, there's very, very few things in this docuseries that I didn't already know or hadn't heard about. But it's fun to see people like Nolan Bushnell, the guy who created Atari, and the guy who created Super Mario Brothers, and like all these, like, they got a lot of the game designers who created the games that we grew up with. Again, another nostalgia trip here.
Dave Grohl in it?
No, he was not, thankfully.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what we call a teaser in the business. It was, you know, like, so the episode structure was kind of chronological. So it starts in the 70s with like Pong and the arcade boom. And then they talk about Nintendo, and there's a whole episode about computer adventure games. And they had the guy who did Ultima and the woman who did King's Quest. And they had all these people who, like, I idolized in the 80s and 90s as someone who loved games. And then it gets into Sega Genesis and Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and, you know, and all that sort of stuff, and esports, and, you know, so they do a really good job of kind of telling the story of our culture and video games going back to the 70s. So if you're into that, you'll eat it up and you'll enjoy it. But it's also done in a way that if someone who's not into video games can also enjoy it. In fact, I think my wife is more into it than I am right now.
So did you also hate it?
No, I understood what he meant by hate it, because it's like, it was kind of eye-rolly. And also I think he meant I would hate it because that Netflix style of documentary series where they not only kind of water down the subject matter, but then they make the subjects do wacky things to illustrate what they're talking about. Uh-huh. So like they had game designers pretending to be in their game and put like computer graphics, like they had the Japanese guy who created Street Fighter II. Right, you got Wes Craven. You got the master of horror. You got the guy who created a genre of fighting game. They made him stand in the middle of the street in Japan and pretend to do the Haruken move, and then they animated it as if there was all this energy coming out of him. And I was like, oh, I feel bad for the translator who had to like hear from the producer, like, now tell him to do this, and like, it was very cringy.
Look on his face, like he was like, I don't want to be doing.
No,
this.
They always seem like they're into it because someone's okay. like the Ultima guy, Richard Garriott, who's a weirdo, like they had him dressed up in full chainmail armor playing D&D with himself, and like it was just like very cringeworthy, and I hate that, but I guess people like that, so what are you gonna do?
I have that conversation with myself a lot. I think I'm the only one who doesn't like this.
Yeah.
So, fine,
but I enjoyed it, so if you like video games, definitely check it out. It's worth it.
Well, we were looking for something to do. We've been watching a lot of movies at night. And I was on Netflix, and I went, I haven't seen Ocean's 11 in a long time. And so we watched that, and then a few nights later, we watched Ocean's 12. And then a few nights later, we watched Ocean's 13. And I really don't think I had seen them since I was in the theater. I definitely saw all three in the theater, and I remember liking them, but that was kind of it.
That's so crazy to me.
I know. I mean, like...
No, I just fascinated. I watch this all the time.
I watch that stuff, though, because you watch like, you have TV, and you're like, oh, that came on TV. I don't ever do that.
Connor, how often is the TV off in your house?
At night, when you're sleeping.
Yeah, right, exactly. No. Like, which is consistent, by the way, since before there was streaming.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the thing. Like it's funny because I don't have cable, and so I never it is rare that I watch a movie again after I see it in the theater. Including Josh, I'm with you. I don't think I've seen Ocean's 12 since I saw it in the theater.
Well, it's not a good one. Let's continue though.
So anyway, you know, I was struck by some of it aged more than I thought. You know, the plot and. You know, everything about the first movie is fairly timeless. Cell phones and smartphones screw everything up, but in fact, they're all before the iPhone, so it's good. But other than that, just kind of the haircuts and Andy Garcia's clothes, but I think those are weird no matter when.
Fantastic. You know, you mean fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, like Brad Pitt's hair in the first one's real bad. Mm-hmm. And in the second one, it's a little Tyler Durden-y. And then by the third one, him and Clooney are just like the guys you know. They haven't hit that next phase. Brad Pitt was a pretty boy, and then at a certain point, he just gets to be he's a little aged, still pretty, but
real cool. You know, your Aldo Raines and forward period. You know,
well, I mean, a lot of ways this is the peak time. I mean, I remember coming out of the first film in Brooklyn, walking home, and there was girls behind me who had been in the theater. They were all debating who would be the hottest guy in the film. Like, this is like...
And they agreed it was Carl Reiner, right?
Well, obviously. Yeah, sure. It was between Carl Reiner and Gould.
Yeah.
But...
By the way, how great is Elliot Gould?
Pretty great.
Just in general.
To me, I mean, if I think about peak Clooney, I think about the first Ocean's film, and you know, when they sort of walk out in those suits, and the cast is terrific, but that's to me like their peaks of cool, you know, where Clooney became like this thing, you know, more than what he already was through these films.
Well, Lindsay and I spent a lot of time trying to like sort out what makes the people attract. Like, I was like, is Clooney really good looking, or is it something else? Is it the look in his eye and the sound of his voice, like if you saw that guy walking around, how would you? But there's a bit, you know, like he looks at the person at the camera and he has like a smirk and you're just like, that's the most charming man on earth, you know. And then Brad Pitt has a different thing going on. Brad Pitt's obviously like he's objectively like a very handsome person, but he's got a coolness too. And it's hard, you know, Matt Damon's in it too, and he's fantastic because he underplays everything and he's very low status through it. And I just hadn't seen him like that in a while. And he looks like a kid in the
He's kind of a
one.
Dork.
Yeah, he is. And I love it. You know, like it's, you know, he really can do like, he doesn't play roles like that anymore. In fact, he's been a bad guy more than anything lately. I mean, but at the end of the day, they're all super fun. You know, yep. I think the third was my favorite. The second is obviously like a little European-y, so it's a little different. It's probably a little too complicated. I don't know if that's the right word, but it just isn't.
It's kind of a mess. A
little bit, yeah. But, you know, like it's super European, like the way it's shot, the soundtrack. So it's like they're all really beautiful to look at. And I you know, you hear that these are the movies that Soderbergh did. These are his mainstream movies, though he could do his indie stuff, and his indie stuff is great. I was gonna say, he's almost like, we don't talk about him quite in the same level as Tarantino or Fincher, but that's silly because he's incredible. I'm trying to think of an analogy, you know, to 70s director or something, but it doesn't matter. Like, he does great, thoughtful, interesting, varied films, and if these are his mainstream movies, I mean, they're gorgeous. Maybe if they didn't have all the celebrities in them, they wouldn't be
as compelling.
Yeah, I mean, or they wouldn't bring in as big of an audience, is what I'm saying. Oh, it would be as compelling, but
yeah.
But the fact that he got all those celebrities to come and be in them over and over again, you know, is amazing.
It's funny that you mentioned this, because Steven Soderbergh was the EP, was an executive producer on the new Bill and Ted movie.
Hmm. I saw that, actually.
Yeah, I was like, oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, but he's like, he really is one of the great filmmakers of our time, and even in this, his most, you know, commercial of movies, I think all of his personality is still there. You know, the soundtracks and the way that second one was shot, like all of the insert shots and things with it, they take a camera from really far away and sort of zoom in or out to somebody in a very 70s European way. It's just all sorts of these things that are fun to look at and watch. And because there's so many people in the cast, it is difficult to talk about the best parts of it. Al Pacino in the third movie was amazing. I was like forgotten about him completely, and I was
good Pacino.
And I was like, is this the last great Al Pacino? Probably not, but it's one of the, you know, like it's, they're getting more rare at that point, I think.
That's a good question. Ooh, yeah. What's the arc of Al Pacino like?
He plays it not down the middle, but you know, he doesn't go over the top too much, and he's
also though he's like he's a straight up bad guy.
Yeah, he's a villain.
He doesn't do that a lot.
If you could pick one Pacino film, which one is it?
Oh, my God.
You only get one.
Oh, my God.
Just pick one. Go. This is totally like psychology, like association. Like Al Pacino, go. Connor.
The Godfather.
Josh. I'd say Godfather as a movie, but I'd say Dog Day Afternoon as a Pacino performance.
100% Dog Day Afternoon. Every time. Every time Dog Day Afternoon.
Serpico, though. He plays with the dog.
He's great at Serpico.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there's Any Given Sunday, just as a Susan.
Josh, you might be correct that might be the last great Pacino film.
I mean, it's a really wonderful performance, and like
he's good in The Irishman. Don't get me wrong, he's good in The Irishman
for sure.
Yeah.
And then I guess the one other thing I wanted to talk about, I love Near Future Heart Sci-Fi. Mm-hmm. Like sure. The Martian, it's one of my favorite modern movies, and so I saw the preview on Netflix for Away. Which is basically like The Martian. It's just the first part of it. There's a crew of five who are going to go to Mars. It's not now, but it's not long from now. And it's, you know, everything is pretty much based on real science as much as is possible to take this journey to Mars. And of course, there's drama and things go right and things go wrong. And there's personal animosities and then friendships and blah, 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 and all that stuff. At the beginning, I didn't really like it very much. I was like, I'm watching this because this is cool. But it was a lot of personal drama. It was a little Parenthood, a little Friday Night Lights kind of thing, but not quite as good.
That's up your alley.
Well, yeah, no, it was just a little too melodramatic with that. It wasn't very fun for a little bit, I guess is the point that I'm getting at. And it turns out that Jason Kadams, who was showrunner of both those shows, wrote at least one of the episodes and was on the writing staff. So there's that. He didn't show create it. But as it went on, and the thing when the characters all sort of do get to know each other and the respect forms and they sort of solve their problems, you know, by the end of the first season, I was like, more, you know, I really dug it. Like just in... I'll take anything out of that genre if it's halfway decent, for sure.
Cool.
And I think it's one of those things that if they do more of them, it will just get better. But great show.
What is the last one you watched before that?
I don't know. I think Ad Astra, which I didn't really like.
Mm-hmm.
That was bad, Pitt.
I still haven't watched that. I got a screener of that last year, and I just never got around to it.
There's some cool stuff, but it's super boring.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it fully. Brad Pitt doesn't have anything to chew on or work with, and so it's all a very like bland, depressed Adderall over a voiceover. It didn't work. There's parts of it that were cool, but
the moon sequence was cool.
Yes, the moon, exactly. That part was amazing. I was like, oh, we're in for it now. The moon sequence. So like, what was it, like a shootout car chase on the moon?
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
This has actually been a busy month for me in terms of stuff that I've been watching. So as I've talked about before, we're alternating shows to binge. We each pick. It's been my choice. I chose Psych, my favorite of the USA Blue Sky early 2000s shows. There was like six or seven of them. White Collar and Burn Notice. And
it was all those shows that were the same, you mean?
They felt like Magnum P.I. They felt like those kind of 80s like action shows. You know, there was like...
That was the SNL sketch, right? The What is Burn Notice?
That's it's one of my favorite ever. Lindsay and I still say it frequently. What is Burn Notice?
It's going to take a while. It's 120 episodes. We're through season two, so it's going to be doing that one for a while. I watched one episode of Chef's Table Barbecue on Netflix, and I had to stop because I don't have barbecue. It was about Snow's Barbecue in Texas, which was voted the best barbecue in Texas, so some might say the best barbecue in the country. It made me so hungry.
I saw that on Netflix, and I said to Carrie, I turned her, I'm like, oh, that's going to be dangerous.
They're lovingly, beautifully shot shows, and the great thing about the episode I watched was that it's a character piece as much as anything, because the chef at Snow's is an 85-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. So technically, she's the best barbecue chef in the country, and she's this 85-year-old school janitor. Snow's is only open one day a week, so she has a day job. And she makes the best barbecue in the country. It's this terrific story about her and her life and the barbecue place. And then there's lots of slow pans over brisket being cooked and then sliced and then eaten. And then sausage and chicken and turkeys. And
easy, buddy. Easy.
I'm literally salivating right now. Thank you. So.
Did either of you ever watch Street Food? It was on Netflix, too.
No.
No.
It was like they went to different countries and did the same thing. They talked about the street food, usually at these Asian countries. It was very similar to that. And it was the same. It was like, oh my God, this food's amazing. That's a really good one.
So even though we're in the middle of Psych, the other day I was like, I need to watch something. I don't want to get into another episode of Psych. And I still have Apple TV. And I heard some things about it. So I started watching Ted Lasso.
Oh, we literally just watched the first episode right before we recorded this.
It is incredible.
That's what really? I heard. Some of my coworkers recommended it. And we started, and literally, like, I was like, oh, we only have about 40 minutes before I have to record. I'm like, let's watch this Ted Lasso. So we're one episode in. So don't spoil it.
I don't spoil it. So it's ridiculous. And I wasn't going to watch it originally, even though I'm a huge fan of Jason Sudeikis, but it is based on a silly concept. So a couple of years ago, when NBC Sports got the rights to the English Premier League soccer, they did a couple of promos with Jason Sudeikis as an American football coach, you know, trying to interact with English Premier League. So the idea of this show, which, by the way, was co-created by Bill Lawrence, the creator of Scrubs, Zach Braff directed one of the episodes, is that this club in London, Everton, hires Bill Lasso, this Division II football coach in America, to come coach the team.
Ted Lasso. Richmond was the team.
Richmond, that's right. You have to sort of accept it. Like, it's silly. It would never happen. You just kind of have to accept that's what the premise is.
You know what it was? Like, halfway through the episode, it's I'm like, this is kind of like Major League. Yeah.
It's a fish out of water comedy between these two American football coaches living in London and dealing with the fans and the team and a different sport. But also, and I'm not going to spoil it for Ron, but Ted Lasso is like the nicest person on television.
Well, I got a taste of it because in the first episode, so the first, whole first episode is him coming over and like meeting the press and meeting the owner. And we said Major League because the owner, she got the team, ownership of the team in a divorce from her husband and is now trying to drive the team into the ground, right? Like that's the Major
to get
League
revenge
angle.
On her husband, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But at the end of the episode, Ted calls his family back back in the States and you only get one side of the conversation and it becomes very apparent that he's on the rocks with his wife and it gets very kind of plinky piano music and like we were like, oh, it's because he seems so genuine and seems so nice and his wife is like, he's like, no, I know I'm giving you space and it's like, oh man.
So what it does is everyone's sort of a stereotype at the beginning and it starts peeling back the layers of all these characters and you start meeting all these really interesting characters and they have interesting relationships, but he is at his core like the most genuine nice person on TV and right now,
yeah,
I need that. And it was just, it's just been so great. And it's hilarious. It's heartfelt. And the relationships in episode 7 now are totally different than ones in episode 1. All these new connections have been made. Characters have been introduced. Total surprise. I put it on as a lark and I'm totally engrossed with it. It's terrific.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. I'm excited. Now we're going to finish it. We're like, let's watch an episode and see how it is. So.
And it's this weird hybrid between like a British show and an American sitcom.
Oh,
like one camera like sitcom because it's set in London. It's shot there. Everybody but Sudeikis and his coach are British. And I think there's like 4 executive producers. I think probably the rest of them are probably British. But it's this weird like American one camera show, but also a British show. It's just, the tone's very interesting.
Like Catastrophe.
It's great. Yeah. It's really, really, really great. And then the last thing, which is going to lead us into our next segment, is that when Bill and Ted Face the Music came out, I was like, I kind of want to watch that. But my wife had never seen the other ones. And so one weekend, we rented all 3 in a row. We watched literally all 3 in one, like Saturday. And so we watched Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and then Bill and Ted Face the Music, which is our main feature tonight. We're going to discuss the film that was supposed to come out in theaters, but instead came out in VOD. And it is the, how many years? 30 years in the making?
When did Bogus Journey come out?
92, I think.
20 plus years?
91. It was 91. So
right. It was 89. So 89 and 91.
Yeah, so 29 years in the making. Yeah.
29 years in the making. Third film in the Bill and Ted Now trilogy, starring Keanu Reeves, Alex Winter, and a whole bunch of other people we'll talk about in a second. Before we get into this film, what is your guys' relationship to these other films, the first two films?
Love them. You crazy? They came out. The first one came out when I was 12.
Yes, we were
right.
All.
Like perfect. Perfect age for that, right? Like it was great. That's how I got introduced to George Carlin.
Mm.
Right? I mean, like, and it was a.
So 12-year-old you came out and said, "Who's that Rufus guy? I want to know more about that."
And then I got the audio tape of his explicit HBO comedy special, and it was I remember listening to that on a school bus with friends, and like that was great. No, I love Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I mean, like the history aspect of it, and it's a legendary. I mean. 30 years later, we will just randomly say San Dimas High School football rules, you know,
every time I used to drive by San Dimas in California,
and there's still quotes from it that still carry through. I think it's definitely a classic. I remember going to see Bogus Journey in the theater. I remember loving it. William Sadler, right, as Death.
Yep.
Yeah, great. I mean, like it was, you know, it got a little weirder. You know, the dude from Faith No More was in it. Like it really touched on a bunch of different notes at the right time at the right age. So yeah, I enjoy this franchise fondly. I wouldn't say like I don't have posters up in my house, and I wouldn't say I followed through on anything. But I was there when it came out and enjoyed it. I don't think I've watched it since.
Well, that's part of my question was when is the last time you saw either of those films?
In the 90s at least. Yeah,
interesting.
So I remember very clearly going to see Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I may have that would have been one of those things that I would have seen the commercials for and been like, I'm totally going to that, which I'm not sure why, because in essence, it doesn't look like something I'd really like. But I was into comedy at that point, like a lot. And there were those kind of movies. I remember loving that first movie, like laughing so hard.
Napoleon at the water park, classic.
I remember the line. Like, how's it going, Royal Ugly Dudes? And just thinking that's the funniest thing I'd ever heard in my life.
Yep.
And I definitely bought that movie on DVD, you know, in my 20s when I was like every Tuesday I'd buy whatever new DVDs came out that I wanted. And I watched that a few times and I kind of always just held, like, in my, it holds a very nice place in my heart in terms of those kind of movies. Bogus Journey, I was looking forward to it. I liked it. It didn't really hit me as much. I know that later people are like, oh, that's the real arty one. And I bet if I'd seen it again, I'd probably think so. I didn't know who Bill Sadler was until a lot later. And I was like, oh, wait, that was that dude. But I watched, before we watched the new movie, I didn't get to Bogus Journey, but Lindsay and I watched Excellent Adventure, and she hadn't seen it in forever. And I couldn't remember much about it other than I was like, I think it's really good. And as I was watching it, that was just bolstered. And I think it's at the end of it, Connor, you had said this about, the Jason Sudeikis character. Yep. Like, Bill and Ted are just really good guys.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
They're really good guys.
Well.
It's a really sweet movie. It's not mean. And then you go along, and everybody that they go pick up, you know,
Billy the Kid, Socrates,
Bill the Kid, Socrates Johnson,
oh man,
and Abraham Lincoln. You know, everybody, they're Sigmund all Freud. Game. There's no like fighting about it. Like there's no conflict
well,
on that.
That
part.
Was a great conversation we had after watching the first one. Was that there's no bad guy. In the first one. In the first film, there's no villain. The second film has a villain, and I have a lot of thoughts on the second film. But the first film is just a romp. It's an adventure. It's literally
it's an excellent adventure.
There's no one trying to stop them. There's no one trying to hurt them. They don't have to stop a bomb from going off. It's literally just, oh, they have to do this presentation at their school about history. They have this time machine. They're just going to get people from the past and bring them to their presentation. And that's the whole plot of the movie. And that, it's so refreshing.
And it's perfect.
And it's so lo-fi. Yep. You can see it's low budget. It doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't matter because everyone in the film is sort of having a great time and being charming. That's what's so great about that first film is that it's just like really charming and sweet.
And it's of the time, but not in a horrible way. You know what I mean? Say we will the Valley People and like the and whatever and the dude and party time, whatever. But like it's in the same way that like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, like that sort of thing. And kind
that's
of
that's a lot darker.
Yes, no, it is. But in terms of like the type of people and like it's like, you know, that sort of thing. The great observation about it not having a villain that is literally just a time travel adventure, and that's awesome. And you don't see movies like that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the second one, I found myself really not liking too much. It totally changes the dynamic of the story.
We see a morality tale.
Yeah, but and then also, like, in the first film, you know, this guy shows up and he says, hey, you two guys who can't even play your instruments, your music's going to change the world. And that idea is kind of silly because they're these hair metal guys who can't play, not hair metal, but they're sort of that weird middle ground between hair metal and rock.
Thrash, a little thrash. Like,
and they can't play their instruments, but these guys are going to save the world through the power of their music. And then that becomes a different thing in the second film. And it even becomes a different thing in the third film, totally. But it changed it. Like, the sweetness of it went away when this guy tries to kill them, and then they end up dying and going to hell. And
I mean, it's stakes. Like, you introduced, like the first movie, they just needed the past history class.
Yeah.
But the second movie, it introduced stakes on a more, you know, threatening the future and all this sort of stuff on the cosmic level. Yeah, so.
So it became a whole, like, more sci-fi story than it. Like, the first film's kind of like this fantasy time travel story. And then became like this dystopian sci-fi tale in the second film. Now, it gets wacky and goofy with Death, who joins the band and plays bass in Wild Stallions. And then there's a whole montage at the end where he's in the. That part works. And then it pays off in the third film. But I don't know. It just sort of it changed the dynamic. It changed the paradigm from the sweet, their music will change the world to like the literal music will change the world, which is what happens in the third film.
I mean, I think it goes back to the first one is be excellent to each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's all. That's literally all it is.
It's their ethos and their music or whatever it is saves the world. And that
they what they're about.
They tinker with it for the second film. But let's talk about the third film. So that's why we're here. So this is set 29 years later.
Now.
Bill and Ted are middle-aged. They have the daughters that they've had with the princesses from the first film who were played by different actresses in all three films. By the way, one of the princesses in the first film was played by the French girl in Better Off Dead.
And one of the princesses in the third film was the woman from Glee, who I haven't seen since then.
They're all different, yeah. So they still haven't written the song that's going to change the world. They're feeling the pressure.
I did like the fact that we see them playing a song at the wedding of one of their brothers is getting married, and they're performing a wedding. They hope this could be the song, and they've gone from metal to Keanu Reeves is playing a theremin, and Alex Winter is doing guttural singing, and like, you know, they've explored every, you could tell just by those choices, you know, that they've explored every type of music to try to find whatever this song needs to be, and just by introducing a theremin into it told that. I was like, good call.
Tuban throat singing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was like, is he throat singing?
So they're feeling the pressure. They haven't written a song, and now sort of reality's coming apart in the future. Now we've got all new people in the future because one of the guys in the first and the second film was Clarence Clemons from the E Street Band. He has died. Carlin's dead. So they had all new people, including Kristen Schaal playing Rufus's daughter, Kelly.
Can I just say, Kristen Schaal played it completely straight the whole time.
Yes.
Normally she goes wacky, and Lindsay kind of can't stand her, which, no. But like this whole time, I was like, you know, she's kind of underplayed. And Lindsay's like, yeah, okay, she's not awful.
So, now we end up in dueling time traveling here, in which they are told they have to go find the song because reality is coming apart in the future. So then Bill and Ted go off in this new time travel device. Meanwhile, their daughters, who are teenagers, female versions of them, basically, they get involved and they have to go off. They're in the phone booth, right? Or is it the other way around?
They're in the pod, the future pod. I will say that maybe 20 minutes into the film, my wife made me pause it and she said, hang on, I want to write something down on my phone. And then when we got to the end of the movie, she showed me what she wrote down and she had predicted the ending,
which I didn't love.
So continue on. I just wanted to get that in there early on. Yeah. And we'll explain what it is later. But yeah.
So the girls go off and we got like a dual path here where Bill and Ted are trying to find the song. So they're going through their own lives into the future. It gets progressively worse as they go
and progressively funnier.
And their daughters are basically recreating the first film. They're going through history to create the ultimate band that they're going to use to try to play the ultimate song. So there's a kind of a nod to both, and then it ends up coming together at the end. I didn't love the fact that Bill and Ted had basically nothing to do with the music that saved the world.
Right.
They came on to do nothing.
Yeah, the spoiler warning and what my wife wrote on the phone was that Preston Logan are not them, it's their daughters. It's the daughters bring the music together and they all play together at the end and save the day. And that's essentially what happened, was that they get told that Preston Logan will write a song that will unite the world. And they basically figure out that it's not them, it's the girls, and the girls bring the band together. And it's up to them. Now, here's the thing that I thought was interesting about this, because you've got two choices with time travel and with all this sort of stuff. You can either try to set some sort of rules to have it make sense, whether those rules apply in physics or not, or you can just say, fuck it, who cares? This is a fun movie. And they chose the latter, because then what happens is that they, as explained by Kid Cudi, they use some sort of quantum blah, blah, blah for them
that
to be
fantastic,
for them to be everywhere at once to help amplify the song. And that's what they did. They supported their daughter's song, and that's how they all came together. But it involved them being infinite number of Bill and Ted's in infinite places at infinite time, giving everyone an instrument so that everyone can play along. And at that point, I was like, oh, this is just all, you know, like, this is nonsense, but it's fun nonsense. It's harmless nonsense. That's where I netted out with it. It was, you know, I didn't love it. I didn't hate it.
The movie or the ending?
Both.
Interesting.
I think at first I was like, there was a little bit at the beginning where I was thinking, oh no. Because I think it is very difficult to watch those men at that age.
Yes.
Not look like I saw them in my head, because obviously.
Well, no, here's the thing about it though. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've seen the John Wick movies, sure. Right? And I've seen Keanu like in public on red carpets.
Yeah.
He looked worse in this movie than he does in real life.
I think they did something to him to make him look worse.
I think they did. Yeah.
That begs questions, but still. And you know what's funny is, after a little while, actually, I thought like I was like, Alex Winter settled
pretty
in.
Good.
Yeah, no, yeah. I know. But as he started going, like, it was really interesting that they both totally did those characters. And I know it seems like they're cartoons and it's simple to do, but you know, 30 years later, that I don't think it's. I think it's a lot.
I thought
easier
Alex Winter had it
done
a little bit better than Keanu did.
He did. Yes, no, he totally did. And he sort of took over it. You know, Keanu's a dumb guy.
Because I feel like Alex Winter's really been living this for longer than Keanu has.
Well, he's become like a director. He does love. But like, I think you're right. No, Ted's dumber than Bill. Bill is Alex Winter. So Bill was always, in all the films, he's like the catalyst. It's his ideas. Ted's more there to react to everything.
Yeah. So at first, and it was just like, I think it was a little creaky to get going. But also, like, you don't know what's going to happen. Like, there's all sorts of reasons why this will not be good. You know what I mean? But as we sort of rocketed towards the end, I thought the daughters were really good again at first. I was like, I don't know. And then I realized, I was like, oh, they're just doing their dad's characters.
Yes.
In the same way. And I thought that was kind of charming. And I was like, oh, they're going to pick up all the people. And I was like, that Jimi Hendrix guy looks amazing from three quarters view, and he should have never started talking. Like, when he was playing guitar, I was like, wow, that's really excellent. But excellent. That was fun. And I will say, like, by the end, they all start playing the song, like, I felt a thing. Like, it built up for me, and, like, it was totally stupid. Like, I'm not going to tell you it wasn't. It didn't make any sense. But it won me over at the end, because the thing is, like, we're going to play this music. Because for a long time, you're like, this isn't going to work. Like, right. There's no way that they're going to succeed at that thing. And it's going to, and so, but they found a way around that. And then they gave you what was, to me, like an authentic feeling through music, which was the whole point.
Now I will agree with you there, but I will say is that surprisingly, I don't think that the movie was like, it was a fast 90 minutes.
They're all like that. They're all like 90 minutes.
Right. No, they all, yeah. And I'm not saying it should have been longer. And I don't know if this is the difference between 43-year-old Ron and 12-year-old Ron, but I felt
not a lot of difference.
I felt like I wanted to see more of the girls' adventure. I felt like there was barely enough of that. And I did think that the Bill and Ted parts were getting a little long in the tooth until about three quarters of the way there, when they got to themselves in prison.
Yeah.
And then when they got to themselves on their deathbeds.
Yeah. That was sweet. That was really sweet.
That scene was great. The prison scene I thought was hysterical. It got better, but I thought the first, you know, third to half of the movie was rough going down for me, at least.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I had. And so,
it felt too fast. It felt too light on both sides. And the stuff I wanted to see, like, I know you want to leave them wanting more, but like, I felt like I didn't get nearly enough. The part of the fun is the traveling through time.
Well, I think that's the consequence of cramming so much plot in when in a 90-minute film, like, when it's just the two of them running around, it's great. But now you've got two sets of story going on in 90 minutes. And there's a lot to get done. On the whole, I had fun watching it. I liked it. It was fun. Yeah. I just didn't like the fundamental changes to the nature of the story, which sounds stupid coming out of my mouth talking about Bill and Ted. But I just love the sweet idea of these two idiots' music, power of the music, not a literal thing, just like, this music is so great, it saves the world, as opposed to making it a literal thing where literally the music saves the world. And I didn't like that change, but that's just me. I did like Death more in the third film than I liked him in the second film. I liked the absurdity of him being in the band in the real world. Like, when they go back to hell, the daughters go to hell to get him, he's got the posters, he's got his memorabilia in his little
room. That was funny.
Like, he misses being in a rock band, you know? And I thought that was funny.
The death stuff was great, I thought.
Plus, he didn't have to worry about aging because he just put the makeup on and he's right. The exact same person, and so that was helpful.
I will say additionally also, probably the thing that got more laughs out of me and my wife was once the psycho robot snapped and became Dennis and became this insecure tag-along. We laughed out loud a lot about that. And then when Dennis and Death were together, it was very funny as well, too.
That was very funny.
Yeah, so, yeah, that was pretty good.
Actually, you know, like, I know you said, you know, it wasn't them, it was their kids or whatever, but I like the fact that the girls existed because of the things that they were like. The girls, like, really knew music.
Oh, I love the character. They were great characters. Ted, I loved this
character. I wanted more of them. I wanted more.
Bill and Ted never... You know, for a long time, you're like, I don't know how they're going to make this band that's amazing. And I think that if you're writing this script, I don't think there was any way to show that either. So, like, the solution out of it is, well, what if because of their, you know, their attitude and their love of music, they create these two other people
who
really do have the ability to do it? And that made a lot more sense to me.
And they also, like, from in terms of economy of storytelling and filmmaking, like, you, like, when they go back to the garage and the girls are listening to something and they're like, wait, is this Monterey Pop? Like, no, this is
I love that.
Like just that exchange shows that these kids are now, like, experts in music and, like, and knowing all that sort of stuff. And, like, and the seeing the array of instruments and, like, the reference to, you know, like, Keanu was thinking about selling the Les Paul for $66,000. Like, you know, like, you got the sense that they continued their love of music and exploring music to write the song and instilled that in their kids, which, Josh, like you, got me a little choked up. So
They were talking about selling the Les Paul, and all the guitars in the garage were like cheap ass Epiphones, and I was like, right, come on.
Well, they clearly had bad money management because in the second movie they're like touring the world, they're playing the Grand Canyon, and now they're living in the suburbs with no money.
Yeah, there was the thing where they were like, there was the danger of the princesses leaving them. And I was like, no, that can't happen.
Yeah.
That's one of those things. Like, Bill and Ted can't fight with each other. and right. the princesses can't leave them, and they're like that family.
Actually, there was three things going on. It was Bill and Ted, the daughters, and then the wives went off on their own time travel adventure.
Which was not needed.
There was too many things going on.
Yeah,
and also that had no real stakes. Yeah. Like they told you it did, but it never really panned out.
It didn't stop the movie from being charming and the actors from being charming. Well, and the whole experience of watching all three Bill and Ted's in a row was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I don't take that away. It for me, never recovered from the second film when they changed the nature of the story. I'm just a purist from the first film.
And I think that's totally fair and valid. I mean, while I enjoyed Bogus Journey, I agree with you. Like, the introduction of hell and this idea of cosmic balance and scales and all this sort of stuff took it out of the historical, factual basis and into a more metaphysical.
And it's the sweetness of these two dummies' music being the thing that saves the world. And you never hear the music, and that makes it even better. So, like... Yeah. You know, I love the sweetness of that. Anyway, it was still a lot of fun. I'm glad they did it. Like, when I first saw the very first still image from it, I was like, oh, no. And the trailer, too, I was like, oh, no. But it ended up being a lot of fun.
There's a real, you know, danger. I mean, this is all we see constantly is people going back to things, you know, like what it was before. But I think the fact that the creators were consistent throughout of it and they had, you know, that voice, that concept got to be the same thing. And it's goofy, but it is sincere. Yeah. Like, there's a real unique thing. There's, you know, you can talk about a lot of goofy 80s movies, but this one stands out. It's definitely got its own sort of thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that sweetness and just sort of good-naturedness of it.
I do want to mention the girls' time travel adventure, which was echoing the first film. I loved that sequence, picking up Mozart and picking up Jimi Hendrix and picking up the flautist that we never heard of and then picking up the ancient drummer. Like, that... all was terrific. I loved Mozart. He was all into it. Also, Louis Armstrong. Like, it was all great. That was all great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't they already get Dave Beethoven? No. That also killed me in the movie theater.
It's just so dumb. It's just so dumb, but it's so great.
Yeah.
Party on, dudes. So I enjoyed it. I hope. Listen, my wife wasn't around for the original films. She wasn't dead, but she just didn't watch them. So she didn't watch them at 12.
She was a baby.
She loved them. She loved all three of them. All three films. Yeah, she loved them.
Lindsay went into the first one skeptical because she's like, this was a dumb movie when I was 12. And at the end, she's like, no, that was really good. Like, it's a good movie. Like, it's stupid, but it's good.
Yep.
And not stupid, not like so bad it's good. Like, there's something about it that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And that's the thing, like going into this, it was like when it came out, I was like, oh, I would have seen it if it opened in theaters and on demand and all that sort of stuff. And I even said to my wife, I'm like, do you want to watch this? She's like, well, if you have to for work, then you can. And I was like, all right, fine. And so I watched it. But like even sitting in through and going through it is that like during it, I knew I'm like, this is not good, but it's not bad. You know, like it's not awful. Like I'm glad that they made it. I'm glad that they rounded it out. Like they kind of put a, you know, kind of put a bookend on it. And it's something that I look back on fondly as a, you know, as movies that I did enjoy. So it didn't tarnish the original, which I think is the bit, you know, this wasn't Clerks 2.
No.
Right.
No, so. No. No, I don't regret watching this at all. I'm not ashamed. Yeah. It was super fun.
Yeah, it was.
My problems are fundamental and not really related to the film itself, which I thought was great. Now I'd like to again mention the death scene. That's where I felt it. I didn't feel it in the music scene, but when they went to visit themselves as they were dying, that's where I felt sort of emotional, having watched all the films in a row. So it was nice. So there you go. That's Bill and Ted Face the Music. And I think it was last episode we said, hey, if you got emails, feel free to send them in to contact@ifanboy.com. Well, we got some.
Awesome.
We're going to do one here today because we're getting close to the edge here. Andy M. writes and says, I'd be interested to hear if you're still using DVD and Blu-rays and what sort of future you think they have. Despite all the streaming options, you're still sort of forced by them to watch what they have when they have it. But if you want to watch a specific film, I think you can't beat DVD Blu-rays. I'm still hanging on DVDs post-rental, but am I the only one?
Fascinating. Good question.
It is.
Let's start with this question. Do either of you have a DVD player?
Yes.
Blu-ray player,
Blu-ray player. Yes.
Yeah.
I
upgraded it.
I got a new one. A 4K one,
Yep. I will say I have one. I bought one. So I feel like I'm a little bit unique because I have a bunch of DVDs and Blu-rays. I moved from California 4 years ago into a smaller apartment. All my DVDs and Blu-rays are still in boxes in a storage unit.
Sure.
So I have not had access to them. Then fast forward 2 years after I moved, and I found myself with access to screeners at the end of the year. mm-hmm. and no way to watch them. So I ordered another Blu-ray player, and now I have them, and it's the yearly watch screeners on Blu-ray player. Aside from that, I don't use it anything else, although I am about to order the DVD set of Mr. Rogers episodes for my kids to watch. Because, listen,
for your kids.
He went and we found out how they make a saxophone, and it was fascinating. And Bill Nye was just on. We're in 1996 now, and Bill Nye is doing science experiments with Mr. Rogers. It was awesome. So I have it just in case, but I can't tell you the last time I bought a movie. I can't tell you the last time I watched one. But that said, I own, like, I have Goodfellas on Blu-ray. I have Indiana Jones. Like, I have the movies I love. They're just in a box somewhere. That's why I might not be unique for it. But I still do agree with you that, you know, there's really no better way. It's like you get the best quality off of the media, off of the disc. You know, versus streaming, you might have artifacts or it might be compression or anything like that. But although it is getting better with 4K. But I will say that in the past 4 years, there has not been a single time where I went to go watch a movie and I couldn't get it streaming. Oh, no, there was. There was one movie that I could not get streaming, and that was The Commitments.
The 25th anniversary Commitments Blu-ray is like 10 bucks now.
I should pick that
almost,
up. Just
I've almost bought it a bunch of times.
Wait, hang on. I'm gonna see if it's actually streaming. Because the thing is, the deals change and they come and go and they go to different things and all that sort of stuff.
We've talked about that before. Josh has talked about losing films in the middle of watching them. You are at the mercy of the streamers and the contracts that have been signed.
You can stream The Commitments on Hoopla.
Like, what the fuck is that?
That doesn't count. That's not one.
And you can rent it from Amazon, Google, YouTube, Apple.
Fine.
Yeah, it's all there.
So, Connor, I assume you're still buying some physical media.
Oh, yeah. I probably buy like 10 Blu-rays a year. Mm-hmm. And I get them from Netflix. I just watched a couple, you know, like Breathless, the Godard film. And
Funny because I just saw that was on TCM and I figured that's why you watched it.
No. I had, before it came on TCM, I'd already had it on sitting on my table. Right. And I've got like The Trip Through Greece waiting. They just arrived in the mail today.
Oh, that was fun. That's a good one. We should talk about that. That was fun.
You know, what's interesting is I have, you know, like in my 20s, I was like every Tuesday I'd buy two or three movies. You know, like I was everything that came out that I liked, I'd get a copy of it and then some. Then when it sort of switched over to Blu-ray, which is a long time ago now. It doesn't seem like it, but it's been a long time with that. That's a standard. You know, I really thinned it down to I'd buy movies that I loved. You know, like there's, you know, like my Tarantino movies and I bought... I can't even think of anything, but like the movies that I loved. And so I have like I have a stack of them, let's say 50, 60 of them. I had 500 DVDs. Like I had a ton of them and I would still buy them occasionally up until relatively recently. And it was relatively recently as we're in this pandemic that I was like, I don't need any more of those.
Yep. It doesn't mean I won't.
It's just that like not everything is available, but there's
crazy.
Something else.
It's crazy. I mean, like, you guys know me. You remember me. Didn't I have the shelves of all the DVDs? I mean, literally, I have not for once wanted any one of them that are in those boxes in the past 4 years. And admittedly, a lot of shit's gone on in the past 4 years that's kept me from watching movies. So it might have to do with where you are in your life. And that's
no, it, but like, I have a living room. I don't live in an apartment. Like, I like to watch a Blu-ray, you know, like with the sound system, you know, like I have... you know, pretty good speakers. I can do the whole, I like that as an experience. I don't do it that often though, because it's like, well, I could just hit the button and it's going now. But also I do actually go back to my DVDs every once in a while because there'll be a movie that I want. I was going to talk about this, but I didn't. I just bought the entire News Radio series on DVD because it was the only way I could watch it.
Nice.
And it was like $20 and they're shitty DVDs, but who cares? You know, like it doesn't matter once you sort of get going.
Right.
But in terms of like a quality, if like I want to watch a movie I love, you can't beat that still. It's just, it's, I don't know what the difference is because there's supposed to be 4K and there's supposed to be, you know, digital surround, you know, DTS sound, but it's not as good. The sound is better on the physical media and the picture is better. It just is.
Yep. It's always going to be.
Yeah.
Because there's a transfer of information from the source to you that you're going to lose stuff as opposed to the playing right from the disc from the machine that's attached to the TV.
You know, I've got my Blu-ray of Goodfellas and Gangs of New York and The Departed and Pulp Fiction and, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, I got all that, you know, that I want to make sure I have.
Yep.
Party on, dude.
Be excellent.
I think for a lot of film lovers, the loss of Filmstruck freaked them out. And the assumption that at a certain point, corporations will look at certain categories of film and say, that's not profitable enough. And, you know, like, I think everyone who loves TCM, like I do, all the backlot members like I am, assume at some point they'll go, why are we doing this?
right?
And it'll be gone. So I still buy stuff. I don't buy a ton, but I still buy five or ten a year. The last one I bought was probably Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, but I still buy,
which you didn't like. No, you did.
No, I loved
it. Okay, that's fair enough. Yep.
When the pandemic started, I bought a bunch. I bought like The Sting, and I bought Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid. I bought a bunch.
That was one of the last ones I bought.
I still buy them. I just don't buy a ton of them.
I worry less about things not being available because that seems less likely than ever, especially at the point where everything has been digitized at some point. Like if it's ever been on a streaming source, it exists. So it's not going to go anywhere in that way.
Well, it exists. The question is, does the infrastructure that it takes to stream it out?
I know, but then exist. I can usually find a copy of it. So, like, it's not, I don't feel like anything isn't available. And the thing of like, well, you don't own whatever, that doesn't bother me in the least.
Right.
I don't I have so much. I do not need to worry about who actually owns the rights or how to use my copy of The Martian. I don't care. I'd love when I get the digital version with the Blu-ray, though. I'm a big fan of that because then they're just always, and there's all those, they're on every service.
I will say, if you don't have Movies Anywhere, that app that kind of gathers up all your digital versions that you either bought from DVDs or that you bought from iTunes or Amazon or whatever and puts them all in one app, that Movies Anywhere is fantastic for movies that you own, right?
Yes.
But
I've got all my David Fincher movies, I've got, all that stuff, like those are worth having.
The time of the year when the physical media pays off the most for me is Christmas time. Because all those films get played eventually, but they may not be playing at the time I want to be watching them.
Yep.
So I have my stack of 15 or 20 Christmas movies that I like to watch in a certain sequence, in a certain order, certain days.
That's a good point, though, because like the lengths that I've got, my wife and I have a tradition of, we have a whole list of stuff we watch during the holidays, including The Grinch and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff isn't streaming.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff you've either got to buy and have on physical media, or you got to go to dark corners of the internet to, like, when you're watching something on Daily Motion, you know that you're really digging.
How you'll get those good Saturday Night Live sketches.
But yeah, I had to do that for how the Grinch Stole Christmas, because it's just straight up not streaming.
I will tell you that for me, vinyl has kind of replaced those things, because
it's your fetish object. It's a different fetish object.
Yeah, but it does. It feels more. I know in my mind that a Blu-ray is just a piece of digital information, and that to me is less appealing because it can be recreated indefinitely. There's nothing sort of, it's nice to have it here, and I know the picture is better and the sound is better, or whatever, but it is not fully solid in that way. And I also know that like those things will wear out. Like they will. The Blu-rays last a really long time, but CDs, CDRs, all those things, like they do have a shelf life, and then that digital information is gone. So, it's kind of silly. But in terms of like a physical object of collecting something, that's totally moved over to vinyl records for me.
Hmm. Well, you couldn't really do that in movies anyway, unless you own like film reels.
Exactly. But for a time, I mean, like I wanted to build a gigantic, movie library that I would carry around with me just, in my life, just like I do books. And like that to me is important. It just seems less important to own it in that format now. As long as you can sort of get to most of it, who cares?
Yep. Agreed.
Let's wrap this up.
Thanks, Andy M, for writing in. contact@ifanboy.com. If you have media questions unrelated to comics, we're happy to answer them on the show.
Love media, to. Put Media Explode in the subject line so we know.
Make sure you do that. It's easier to find them as well in the inbox. So that's it. That's the show. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month with more non-comics media that we enjoyed in the last 4 weeks.
Can I quickly plug a couple of things? Sure, I don't often come on for those listening out there.
Sure.
You could also listen to me weekly over at All About Android at twit.tv/AAA, where I talk about Android phones. That's my other podcast. But I also launched a new company. If you're into pinball, check out scorebit.io, where you can check out the mobile app that we made to track your pinball scores. And we made it a little device called the Scorbitron that goes in your pinball machines. So those of you who are iFanboy people, check out scorebit.io. I've been working on it for the past couple of years. Very proud of it. Thank you.
Why don't you spell it for the people?
scorbit.io.
There you go. All right. So we'll be back in a month. We got lots of stuff going on. We have our weekly Pick of the Week show. We have our monthly hangout. We have our Talksplodes and Booksplodes and all kinds of things happening. So there's no lack of podcasts. They're all at fanboy.com. You can check them out there. And until next time, I'm Connor.
I'm Josh.
And I'm Ron.
There he is.
Hey.
Party on, dudes.
That's supposed to be the last one. It's be excellent to each other. Party on, dudes. You keep leading with that, and it's messing the whole thing up.
I was capping the show with it, but that's fine.
Yeah. You would. So what you should have done.
Be excellent to each other. Party on, dudes!